I want to kick it off with mentioning that hopefully there's a Zoom way of getting to the IMC's membership meeting that's today at 1 to 3. You were talking about canceling an event, I think, weren't you?
Yeah, we got one. We're going to have to do
it's,
something.
It's coming down pretty it's thick and down. Steady. The information that I had on the web and on the back of the public eye doesn't include the possibility of Zooming in, but that might be a good thing for a media center to have available. Working groups, hint, hint, if you're listening, Miriam, I'll shoot you a note, because I live about four blocks away, so I'll make it there, but other folks
may not.
May not. Yeah, they might be hurting their back shoveling their snow or something. Financial Report 2026 Programming Sneak Peek, asking for input about programming. Vote for the Board of Directors. Gus Wood is currently president. I haven't heard whether he's, I guess I'll ask him. Labor, Radio Free Labor coming up. I guess I should run down what I'm going to run down today. I've got some Marjorie Cohn. She's a brilliant journalist. I mean, lawyer. She's a lawyer. But she does write a lot on her own website, Marjorie Cohn. And I'm going to get to something from her about this whole brouhaha about legal or unlegal orders. The caliber of discourse in this country. I wanted to say something about Venezuela situation. I'm trying to figure out where that oil was going. It was under the pretense at first that it was somehow Iranian oil, and I said, why would one oil-producing state be shipping oil to another oil-producing state? And there's distinction between different kinds of oil. Trump talks about the gas price being down. He doesn't want to bring up diesel because diesel is pretty high. The heavy crude that's in Venezuela is suitable for diesel fuel more than gasoline. And I think the crude in Iran is... So they were supposedly doing a swap of oil, according to one analyst. But now I'm seeing that it was going to Cuba, which makes a whole lot more sense. But then I saw an article, and I haven't had time to pull it down yet, that suggests that they were brokering the oil, Cuba was. They were going to be selling it on to Asia, probably China in some way, the skipper, this the biggest one. Oil tanker. So piracy at the high seas. So I've got a little bit on Venezuela. I'm going to read again about the stuff that you don't hear about Machado. I've been getting to that fairly regularly because it's glaringly omitted from the discourse. So Marjorie Cohn, if you've listened to folk music and you like politically engaged film folk music, you know David Rovix, and I'm not going to hear from him directly, but we're going to hear one of his songs. Google decided that his whole YouTube channel was inappropriate, so you can't listen to David Rovix on YouTube. I'm sure there are other ways directly from him. Also, a journalist who was a stringer for... Iran's Press TV got his entire product, his Google Docs and his Google Mail, all verboten, forbidden from him. And he ought to go to a lawyer and see if he can at least get parts of his book back that he had up on Google Docs. Why he didn't have a direct backup, I don't know. Amy Goodman's got something on what... Trump is doing in his racially motivated ways about the national parks and also remembering Rosa Parks. I guess it was some anniversary of her birth this week. It's a good, well-crafted essay. Update to that is that he's also micromanaging the gift shops at the national parks, making sure there's no DEI, related products to be purchased at the gift shops of the national parks. That seems to be pretty astonishing to me, the level, how low can the man go? I'll probably play the Gloria Riva piece I have next week. She was here on campus some time ago. She was doing a report back from Venezuela some time ago. No fresh Mumia. There's a longer piece that I'll probably try to put on tomorrow about colonialism and Israel-Palestine. He's broken his two-minute, three-minute, four-minute format. But I did want to note that if you want to know about him, I've been saying that he's losing his vision and he needs to be getting better health care. Amy Goodman had a segment this week interviewing some people that had a demonstration and were talking about trying to get some proper health care for Mumia in his late days. He should have a geriatric release, in my opinion. Been in for some 50 years. Okay, that's not cooperating. There we go. All of a sudden, works. So let's kick it with breaking the sound barrier from Amy Goodman. I'm a little under the weather, as the expression goes. And so is this Windows program, computer that I'm working with right here. And hopefully we can listen to Amy Goodman's Break the Sound Barrier essay right now. I'll get an underwriting announcement in straight away, too.
From Rosa Parks to national parks, Trump's racism and bigotry demand resistance. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. This month marks the 70th anniversary of Rosa Parks' arrest for refusing to give up her bus seat to a white passenger in Montgomery, Alabama. Her courageous act triggered the historic Montgomery bus boycott, launched the career of a young preacher named Martin Luther King Jr., and changed the world. Remarkable events like the boycott have long been celebrated in this country as seminal moments achieved through struggle woven into the fabric of our collective civic life. President Donald Trump and his MAGA enablers are on a campaign to erase this history, tearing down monuments to hard-won progress and whitewashing American history to conform to their white Christian nationalist agenda. Take the recent changes to the National Park Service's fee-free days, when the park admission fees are waived. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday and Juneteenth have been stripped from the list of fee-free days, and Donald Trump's birthday has been added. Gone are the only 2 days that celebrate Black history, which is, in fact, American history. Other examples are Trump's restoration of Confederate monuments, torn down in the wake of the 2020 police murder of George Floyd and the racial justice protests that followed, and his reversal of the renaming of military bases formerly named after Confederate officers, as Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth declared,
"No more woke bullshit."
Trump's discrimination and erasure aren't limited to race. Within weeks of taking office, the National Park Service removed the T from LGBT on its Stonewall National Monument website. The pivotal Stonewall Uprising, credited with launching the modern gay rights movement, was prominently led by transgender activists. It occurred in New York City's Greenwich Village around the Stonewall Inn, an LGBTQ plus bar attacked by New York City police on June 28, 1969. In recent years, Trump has been inciting virulent transphobia in his campaign to harness hate for political power. Juneteenth, June 19th, commemorates the end of slavery in the United States. On that day in 1865, Major General Gordon Granger of the Union Army ordered the emancipation of enslaved people in Texas. Juneteenth is considered the longest continually celebrated African-American holiday, and it's the newest federal holiday. The effort to make Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday a holiday was itself one, only after a decades-long struggle. It was first celebrated as a federal holiday in 1986, while many states resisted. South Carolina was the last to adopt it in 2020. To this day, Alabama and Mississippi officially mark the holiday as the joint birthday of both King and Confederate General Robert E. Lee. Purging MLK Day and Juneteenth from the National Park Service's fee-free days is not trivial. It signals official government-sanctioned and enforced racism and bigotry originating in the Oval Office and radiating throughout the government, the media, and our society at large. As Professor Jean Theo Harris writes in her book, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, she did not sit down on that bus because she was a tired seamstress. Rosa Parks was secretary of the Montgomery branch of the NAACP. She'd received training in nonviolent resistance at the renowned Highlander Center in Tennessee, where people like King and folk singer and activist Pete Seeger spent time working to build movements for racial and economic justice. Rosa Parks wasn't the first, either. Earlier that year, 15-year-old Claudette Colvin was also arrested in Montgomery for refusing to give up her seat. Decades later, she recalled her decision speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
I could not move because history had me glued to the seat because it felt like Soldier on the Truth, hands were pushing me down on one shoulder, and Harriet Tubman, hands were pushing me down on another shoulder, and I could not move.
History matters. History motivates. Donald Trump knows this and is attempting to purge the history of progressive struggle waged by communities of color and other marginalized groups. Meanwhile, key advances that took decades, even centuries, to achieve are being rapidly undone. The U.S. Supreme Court is unabashedly advancing the MAGA agenda, most recently approving a racially gerrymandered congressional map for Texas that clearly violates the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Neither the Constitution nor legal precedent will stand in the way of the court's right-wing majority as they rubber-stamp one noxious Trump priority after another.
Let us realize that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice.
Martin Luther King Jr. often said, in his letter from a Birmingham jail, King criticized not merely, quote, the hateful words and actions of the bad people, but the appalling silence of the good people, unquote. Authoritarianism is on the rise here at home and abroad, fueled by demagogues like Trump. There is no option but to resist. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan. From Rosa Parks to
Oh, my. Why are we hearing that repeat? Okay. Now I've got that taken care of. Okay, I promised something about Venezuela. There's a New York Times article I haven't gotten around their paywall yet, confessing on the radio that I do that, but well. That says that it was a financial transaction. It wasn't actually going into the Cuban oil economy directly. This is related to the oil tanker, and apparently they're going to grab some more. Now, there are some international sanctions of Iranian commerce, but since it's not Iranian oil, it's only the sanctions that the U.S. has unilaterally declared against Venezuela that have been going on for a decade, well, maybe just under a decade, under both Democratic and Republican regimes, administrations. This one's more like a regime. Machado got such good press. It was fawning. It was ridiculous. I've been sending this text from NACLA. It includes some stuff that I'm not quite down on in the conclusion, but this section is very telling. A week after she received the award, she telephoned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a genocidaire with an arrest warrant at the International Court, and congratulated him on the decisions and the firm actions during the war, as well as Israel's achievement. Since 2020, Machado's party, Bente Venezuela, has been linked to Likud through a formal alliance. Machado also supports far-right parliamentary group Patriots for Europe, which includes Spanish party Vox, Marie Le Pen's party, I forget what it's called, and other European Trumpists. In her message to the Patriot Summit in February of this year, Machado declared their fight and hers were part of the same global struggle, the struggles taking place in Venezuela, like those we were waging taking place in Europe, like those we are waging in Venezuela, have the same values. And I hate when that happens. She asserted that both the Patriots and her own movement embodied strong movements and leadership based on values. This, again, is her address to the Patriots for Europe far-right parliamentary group. Again, Vox, Marie Le Pen, I suppose Viktor Orban's in that too, I don't know. So here's a lot of history in a very few short moments with Max Blumenthal. I think this is fair use. It's been clipped by a number of places around the internet, and 4 minutes and 16 seconds long. I was going to play something from Gloria LaRiva, where she talks about how the opposition burnt down a warehouse full of medicines. This is some years ago. This is all going on sub rosa. But let's see if I can punch this up correctly.
Truth about the CIA founding the Cartel of the Suns to ship cocaine in the United States was exposed to a national U.S. televised audience by Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes in 1993, back when 60 Minutes reported on the CIA and not on behalf of the CIA. And just quickly to respond to Virtual Ambassador Story, who accused me of ad hominem attacks, you are a government official, you are a veteran coup plotter, and it is legitimate for a journalist to scrutinize the activities of a coup-plotting government official who in February 2021 hosted a insurrectionist summit at the Marriott Hotel in Bogota, you with Leopoldo Lopez, the U.S.-backed coup leader who staged multiple failed military coups and led violent riots that saw Afro-Venezuelan citizens burned in the streets. Check out Orlando Figuera. And Carlos Vecchio, the fake ambassador to Venezuela, who is actually the lawyer for ExxonMobil, which seeks to regain its control of Venezuelan fields. This is one of the most deeply anti-democratic opposition movements led by Maria Corina Machado, who has led several coup attempts in Venezuela. I mean, it's basically like January 6th again and again with the sponsorship of the U.S. embassy. Violent riots that have killed hundreds. I personally watched Maria Corina Machado attempt to take over La Carlota Air Base in Caracas while the U.S. was trying to ram aid trucks into Venezuela, which the Venezuelan opposition subsequently burned and blamed on Maduro. This is a corrupt opposition that stole millions of dollars from Citgo after the U.S. stole it from Venezuela. This is a corrupt opposition that has paid millions to U.S. mercenaries like Jordan Goudreau, who I interviewed, who has personally described to me what the real agenda here is, which was for Trump Incorporated cronies to get their hands on contracts and to plunder Venezuela's rich mineral wealth and oil. Ambassador Story revealed the agenda himself when he appeared on a straightforward propaganda piece for regime change on 60 Minutes and said, Nicolas Maduro is a bad actor sitting on the world's largest oil reserves. Well, that's why you consider him a bad actor, because there's plenty of bad actors in the world, and neither of you will condemn ICC wanted war criminal Benjamin Netanyahu or call for his arrest, will you? Neither of you will talk about Ecuadorian President Daniel Noboa's role in the international drug trade through Benita and his family shipping company. I mean, the list goes on and on. I could spend the next 45 minutes talking about U.S.-sponsored bad actors, but they're our bad actors. The reason Maduro's a bad actor is because he's sitting on oil reserves.
I think it's only fair that rather than giving you another 45 minutes to expand on that, let me ask Ambassador Story for his... I'm going to give you a right of reply to that, so respond. I mean, of course.
You can seek out the right of reply. I wasn't sure how that ended. That was Max Blumenthal. And again, that little screed is floating around. I hope he writes it up, too, because that encapsulated about a lot of the history that the CIA was doing before it got official authorization to do it in public by Trump. Go figure. Did I say opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station? I did say that I was going to do an underwriting announcement. And let's see, number six. Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Live Action Games. If you're looking for a wide selection of classic and modern video games, consoles, controllers, books, and collectibles, Live Action Games has you covered. It's open Tuesday through Saturday, 111 North Market Street. That's right next door to an F, to where 113. And, oh, I didn't mention there's a little cocoa gathering holiday party send-off for the Nice Wanders from 3 to 6. So there's two media events today. Depending on the snow, I may have to give my regrets. Anyway, back to the script. It's right next door to WEFT. New and gently used inventory arrives daily. For a list of in-stock items and additional live-action games information, please visit lag217.com or call 217-359-GAME. Say good day to the Australian owner of SAME. We appreciate his support. And if you have a small business, a chess club, swim club, I don't know, some kind of club, you want to get a mention on the radio? Always like to hear the responsible investing one from Russ Rybicki, supporting the Courier. Okay, what do we got on the clock? It's time for me to turn it over to more articulate ones. This, however, is a musical interlude. It's really intense, I'll warn you in advance. And this has got to do with the fact that Dave Rovick's political troubadour has had his YouTube channel pulled down. I don't know if they took down the rest of his Google-related, alphabet-related material, like the journalist that'll also be talking. I should have included Rovick's, but this is from the Monday Flashpoints, if you want to hear Dave Rovick's talking about his reaction to having his body of work up on YouTube. I'm sure there are other ways to find it, but YouTube is a popular podcasting basis. Not that I use it much, but anyway, let's get to David Rovick's song about... maybe it's the one that got him booted.
Your work meant a lot to some of the listeners throughout the year and throughout this genocide. And let's listen, see why, if censors really do want to censor you, if they're afraid of, let's sort of see if we get a sense of what they might be afraid of. I think we've got something queued up.
Camps open air, that's the one thing that distinguishes what has happened in Gaza right now compared to the time of the Third Reich and its crimes against any decency, against any sanity, against all the children, against all humanity. Auschwitz to Gaza. Gaza, there's no difference between babies and fighters on that side of the fence, the side where they starve because the food is kept out by the occupation, and no others, no doubt, where people are dropping dead on their feet while searching for crumbs of food on the street. Night and all day, or the people inside just wasting away. Everyone waiting for death to arrive, shot or starved or burned alive, where each passing moment is punctured by groans of a million children as thin as their bones. To Gaza, the outside world knew, and many lamented about what they might do while their leaders looked for money to be made in the arms trade. Once again, just like this, profiting from the apocalypse. From Auschwitz to Gaza, the stages of starvation are exactly the same under occupation. First the fat goes, then all the rest, the muscle, the marrow, the milk in the breasts of all nursing mothers as in front of their eyes, their babies cry, their last little cries. Auschwitz to Gaza, under either command, all of the killing is entirely planned. Whether they call it a camp or a zone, it's all the same skin and bone. Whether they say work makes you free or humanitarian city. From Auschwitz to Gaza, the political line, from occupied Poland to Palestine, leaders outside will say we weren't aware of the extent of the horrors happening there. They'll shed a few tears and somberly then make a speech at the UN. Auschwitz to Gaza, all over the place, the lies of the leaders who seek to save face will say we would have acted if only we knew all that they claimed they really would do. And no one will believe at the time when some foolish person says ever again. From Auschwitz to Gaza.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We are talking with David Rovics. This is our weekly segment with Sam Husseini. We call it Genocide Watch. We focus on what's been going on in the situation in the West Bank now, as well as obviously the Gaza Strip. And let's bring in our journalist, Sam, and let's talk about what censorship might look at, the level of journalism.
Absolutely. And, you know, before I bring Robert in, I just want to emphasize, David, I think, is unique because he's a musical artist encountering this, and I think he's the first musical artist to have their entire catalog nuked. And we recently saw, after the Trump administration sanctioned several Palestinian human rights groups because they were cooperating with the International Criminal Court against Israel, that it nuked all of their YouTube accounts as well. But we have Robert Inklesh with us, and his case is fascinating because all of his accounts on Google were obliterated, and there was an excellent piece in The Intercept recently, which also included some insights by a Google whistleblower in the case. Welcome, Robert. Can you brief people about your case, please?
Thanks for having me. My case is perhaps even more interesting than I originally thought it to be, because many people have had their YouTube accounts pulled down before. What eventually happened to me after they originally pulled my YouTube account down without any community guideline strikes or any warnings in February of 2024, is that they then followed up and deleted another account, which I hadn't made any comments or put up any videos on that. It was just sort of a burner account that I had sitting there. That was deleted. And then later on, earlier this year, Google then pulled my email, and obviously then I lost access to my G Drive, Google Docs, which I have a lot of content, including the first chapter of a book I was writing, which was just completely lost. And the only explanation I had for any of this was originally that YouTube had said I, you know, committed serious community guideline violations or whatever, although I never had any strikes. I then had a Google insider who reached out internally and eventually got a few different answers. One claimed that I had been posting like spam material, for instance. It sort of rested at that. And I had assumed, I'd been told by somebody that perhaps I'm on a blacklist. So I just thought, okay, I'm being targeted because my YouTube channel, I have live streams documenting Palestinian children being shot. My journalism on the ground in Palestine was all there. A lot of that stuff it has been deleted and I don't have any archive of. So I thought that, you know, that was the case. Like, okay, I've been targeted because I'm talking about Palestine. But that was until I was reached out to by Jonah at The Intercept, who wrote the piece. They sort of inquired on my behalf and they got the answer back that my channel had actually been pulled down. This has been hidden from me because I was part of an internal investigation from, I believe, their cyber threat unit or something like that, an internal investigation into Iranian influence campaign, an Iranian state influence campaign, which was a great surprise to me. That turns out to be the real reason. They're essentially accusing me of being a foreign agent, but would not actually tell me that directly.
Now, you had worked for Press TV, which is aligned with the Iranian government, but that was several years ago, is that right?
Yeah, and I've done freelance work with them. And by the way, I mean, this is a point that I made as well to Jonah when he was writing the piece and when he came back to me with this information. Plenty of people work for different media outlets. I've worked with RT. I've worked with TRT. I've worked with various different media outlets backed by Qatar, for instance. Am I a Qatari agent, a Turkish agent? Am I an agent of the Russian government as well? Because I did work and I'm a freelance journalist. I publish pieces with an enormous amount of outlets. The most of the pieces that I write are for independent media outlets that are funded by their readers. And if you follow me and my work, you'll know that. But
you know, I usually see you on the Palestinian Chronicle. So yeah.
Yeah, majority of the work that I do right now is for the Palestine Chronicle. I write pieces for them almost daily at this point. So to try and accuse me of being a foreign agent, because as a freelance journalist, I publish pieces in state-run media of different countries. At the end of the day, if I was offered the ability to write freely and do investigative work or make documentaries for the BBC, I would do so. If they gave me full editorial control and allowed me to do what I wanted to do, and to tell the truth, I would do as such. I don't see the problem with publishing things which are correct, in my view, correct. I'm being honest with my reporting. People talk about objectivity. I don't believe any media can be fully objective. I just don't think that's even possible. But what I do believe is that in journalism, you have to have integrity and you have to publish things that you believe to be correct. And if you're wrong, you explain yourself and you correct yourself. But where you go and publish that information as a journalist should not then make you become an agent of that media or outlet, especially if you're a freelance journalist. I did work as a correspondent and in the office of Press TV in the UK for a number of years. But again, that does not make me an agent of Iran because I did that. Mehdi Hassan worked for Press TV. Jeremy Corbyn worked for Press TV. Are they agents of Iran still now, even though many years ago they worked for Press TV? That doesn't make any sense. And I think that's a smear. And to accuse me of being a foreign agent and then take down my private YouTube page and delete the journalism that I had on there, some of which is not backed up, is, of course, that this is an attack on the freedom of the press. I feel that very strongly. I think it's a ridiculous allegation to try and paint me as a foreign agent. You can see my reporting is consistent and my views are consistent throughout any of the outlets that I have worked with.
Right. Go ahead.
Dennis Preston here with Sam Husseini. Go on, Sam. Go on.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit more about the role of the whistleblower Mark Cohen, who resigned from Google and brought to light? Because they originally told you that it was a spam account, it was a scam account. It violated community standards and so on. What was the role of Mark Cohen, the who had worked for Google?
So originally in February of 2024, when I made a post on X about it, he reached out to me. He personally reached out to me, and he tried to see what he could do to help. I think originally maybe he thought that perhaps he could, you know, right this wrong, that perhaps there had been a mistake made. But I think at that point he already knew there were problems internally, and this was part of his journey. But he tried to help me from the inside and tried to at least get answers for me, but he couldn't get those answers because, you know, they came back saying spam and scam account. And then the first time that he'd sort of inquired, they just said, yeah, community guidelines. And so they gave these different excuses to him. And then in the end, you know, they just stopped replying to him. And then, yeah, after that, I think I had given up on the prospect of getting my account back. I believed maybe at the start that there could have been a problem. Maybe I was mass reported by Israeli accounts, right? And that there could have been a targeting of my account by Israelis or bots. But it very soon became obvious that this campaign was very targeted and that these decisions were not going to be taken back. But the interesting thing is that even though Mark had inquired internally and had spent time, you know, he took time out of his days to try and deal with this issue and try and get an answer for me, he wasn't able to get that answer, even though he worked inside Google. So I think that's very telling, that I wasn't even able to get answers from somebody who was working inside Google. It took literally The Intercept almost 2 years later to inquire to find out the true reason that they'd actually gone after my account. And then, of course, they haven't told me this. So, you know, I don't understand if you're claiming that, you know, I'm an agent of Iran, I'm a part of a foreign government's influence campaign, then I'm sure you should be able to tell me, because you must have evidence of this. And of course, they have no evidence. And that's why I believe they didn't tell Mark either, because if you're going to claim something like this, you have to present the evidence for it. But of course, somebody like me, what am I going to do in this situation? You know, hire a lawyer and try and sue Google? That's that would be my only course of action. Or where do I even start with that? You know, that's I don't even know how I would approach that issue.
Sure. Dennis?
Yeah, it's really important to get to hear this and this struggle to get information out. Speaking of getting the actual information out, I wonder if I could just take a few minutes with you to have you assess it's almost the forgotten genocide at this point. But how would you assess from your vantage point, the way you have followed this expanding genocide? Where is this war now? Do you see this as just now a pause, or not even a pause, between expanding wars? How do you see the situation on the ground now with the incredible power that the Israeli government has, just at least militarily?
I believe that a pause is perhaps a better way to describe it than a ceasefire. Ultimately, what's happened is the Israelis weren't able to achieve their objectives through the military means which they were employing in the Gaza Strip. There were no solutions for them. So what had happened under this so-called ceasefire plan is that they get a break and they can focus on other fronts if they want to. Their military gets a break, and then they can try to implement a number of different schemes, like for the UNSC resolution that was passed just recently. They will try to bring in the so-called International Stabilization Force, which will be, in essence, a invasion force in Gaza. That's at least what the Israelis and the Americans intend it to be. And so they will try and do the Israeli military's dirty work of so-called disarming Hamas and the other Palestinian groups. I personally think this will fail. I think these schemes will all fail. It will all collapse. There's so many signs of this right now. Just the other day, the Egyptian government released a statement saying that the International Stabilization Force will be a peacekeeping force, which, of course, it will absolutely not be a peacekeeping force. The U.S. government has made it clear that that's not the intention. We also know that the private military contractor firm UG Solutions has been doing a recruitment drive recently because it wants to involve its armed thugs in potentially coordinating and other potential roles for their forces in Gaza with this so-called ISF. It's a regime change operation, but I think it's a regime change operation that doesn't seem like it's got many legs, this so-called ceasefire and the second phase of it, which I think they're going to drag this on for some time until it no longer becomes of use, and then they could go back to what they were doing before. If they haven't found any other solutions. So I think they're just testing. This is a phase of testing and seeing what they can get away with, what they can implement, what will work, what won't work. And this is just the way that they've sort of been experimenting with Gaza the whole time. You might remember the U.S. military and its floating aid pier failure, which was a waste of taxpayer dollars. And then the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, so-called, which turned out to be a death trap and resulted in the gunning down of 2,600 people. Again, they just implemented it and hoped, hey, maybe this is going to work, and we'll set up a concentration camp which will be governed by Israeli-backed ISIS-linked forces in Rafah, in the south of Gaza. But of course, all of these plans, all these schemes end up collapsing because they're not well put together, and the Israelis don't have a realistic vision for the future. Even when it comes to the forces, the Palestinian collaborator forces that they back, they're not even intelligent about the way that they do that. And they pick the people who are like the lowliest of the low, thugs, criminals, and takfiri Salafists to do their work, which, of course, would never work in governing Gaza. So right now we're in this phase where we're watching on, and we're going to see where it goes. They'll try and implement a number of different schemes, but ultimately it's a testing phase. That's the way I see it. And they might move on to their war on Lebanon and some operations in Syria, an attack on Iran while the pause is in place in Gaza.
And Sam, you get the closer.
Yeah, well, I think that that's a really good analysis, although I sometimes, you know, I don't buy that necessarily that Israel's stated goals are ever its actual goals, including getting rid of Hamas. That is, you know, what they have done is consistent with their goal being, damaging Palestinian society and committing genocide as much as they can possibly get away with. And Hamas is sort of the pretext for that, and things like, you know, the fake pier that they had and other things are simply stalling tactics so that they can keep, you know, so that there's a solution around the corner that the U.S. government says is going to resolve the situation. Meanwhile, Israel continues getting away with war crimes virtually every day. They're killing, 5 or 10 people in Gaza now rather than, 1 or 200. But it's still continuing, and if they can sell it media-wise, it will dramatically increase. And with increased censorship, that opens the door for them doing it and getting away with it better than they have before.
Amazing, Robert. Is there any hope? Is there anybody in the corporate press that actually has had the courage to come near what the truth of the story is in terms of the nature of occupation, or is it a hopeless case once again really left up to independent reporters, human rights activists to get the truth? Sometimes we have to get it through poetry. It's so hard in terms of what really is happening on the ground. Any hope anywhere?
I don't have much hope in the corporate media, and that's because of their performance and the way that they continue to carry on essentially whitewashing genocide and acting as stenographers for the Israeli Foreign Ministry. There are occasionally good reports which come out, and then good journalism which happens in mainstream corporate outlets. I won't discount some reports which are done, there are journalists still that do have some integrity, but the vast majority of the reporting in the corporate media, you're better off going to the Israeli Hebrew media, you'll get a better representation of what reality is, because the Western corporate media is just a fictional world that they invent in order to try and convince Western people of a certain argument that is pro-Israel.
All right. Sam Husseini, we thank you. We thank our guests. And we are happy to continue to try and tell the truth about what's really going on the ground in endlessly occupied Gaza, where the violence may have been paused, as our guest suggested, but paused is the word. You are listening.
Flashpoints, Dennis Bernstein, the host there. The guest, again, is Robert Inlakesh, I-N-L-A-K-E-S-H, went to Palestine Chronicles, as Sam Husseini mentioned that. He has a December 13th article, Why Israel is Pushing for Regime Change in Venezuela Through Washington. And he chronicles the whole campaign of think tanks, et cetera, doing build-up for an attack. It's a pretty comprehensive read. Again, The Intercept has a piece on him from December 7th, journalism reported from Palestine. YouTube deleted his account claiming he's an Iranian agent because he was a stringer for Press TV, the Iranian TV, for a number of years ago. He's based out of the UK, I guess. Opinions are those of the speakers, of course, not necessarily shared by others at the station. And as usual, I always overshoot. So I'll tell you where you can find this one. That was from Flashpoints Monday, KPFA archive. That one is titled. So often they aren't titled. They're under pledge drive. So I guess a rousing attack on the mainstream media is probably a good thing. Maybe I should mention again two media events in our community. The IMC's 2025 member meeting, 1 to 3 today. So shovel your way out and make it over to 202 South Broadway if you're interested. Programming input for the next year, as well as a preview of what's already been planned. Financial report, vote for board of directors. And then from 3 to 5 here in downtown Champaign at the WEF Studios, there's an open house with some cocoa and holiday cheer, and also send-off for the Nice Wanders, Mark and Vicky, going to Colorado to be with their daughter. Maybe you want to say hi to them. They were doing the Friday wake-up show, Weekender, for quite a few, and did a lot of work here at the station, board of directors, etc. All right, even less time to play this section with Marjorie Cohn. I hope I have a good edit point in 13 minutes or so by that clock. Actually, 14 by this one. No, just anyway, Radio Freely Labor. Gus will be shoveling out and making his way over, and looking forward to that. Well, I guess I'm going to digress again. We know about the Epstein bill being passed through this way of short-circuiting the leadership in the House, which is really a great idea. And it's been used again. I was thinking maybe it would be used to remedy this crisis in the funding of the Affordable Care Act subsidies, even though I see that as a real lame stopgap, but yeah. It's a crisis for a lot of people at the turn of the year. But it's also been used to allow 20 Republican House members to vote for reinstatement of union rights for all of the workers that Trump disenfranchised by decree. Now, there's a lawsuit saying that, well, you can't do that by decree, but this would write it into the law, which in sort of a way it already is, but yeah. The Wagner Act. Anyway, it may be one of those bicameral agreements where they decide that they'll get their name on record for their election campaign that they're supporting labor, but then they know it'll be killed in the Senate anyway. But maybe it won't be killed in the Senate. And maybe the discharge petition method of getting around Speaker Johnson will be used for other. This next segment is from Law and Disorder from December 8th with the great Marjorie Cohn. That's spelled C-O-H-N as opposed to other variant spelling. I played her on Law and Disorder on another subject. This is probably pretty wide-ranging as it typically is, but it's starting with this whole idea of military orders and whether what the military will do in a case that they are told to shoot people while they're drowning.
The extent to which Donald Trump is willing to go to dismantle the rule of law at home and abroad is breathtaking and dangerous. In some cases, leaders are pushing back, but in other cases, major institutions are enabling Trump's lawlessness. To discuss examples of both, we're very pleased to be joined by Marjorie Cohn. She's Professor Emerita at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, Dean of the People's Academy of International Law, and past president of the National Lawyers Guild. She sits on the National Advisory Board of Veterans for Peace, and she's co-author with Kathleen Gilbert of Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. She's been called to testify at military courts-martial about the legal duty to disobey unlawful orders, and she writes a regular column for Truth Out. And let's not forget, she's a former co-host of this show, Law and Disorder. In a recent 90-second video organized by Senator Alyssa Slotkin, Democrat of Michigan, two senators and four Congress members, all U.S. military or CIA veterans, took turns reading a statement addressed to active service members, urging them to refuse to follow illegal orders. Quote, like us, you all swore an oath to protect and defend this Constitution, the lawmakers said. Quote, our laws are clear. You can refuse illegal orders. No one has to carry out orders that violate the law or our Constitution. Immediately on Truth Social, Trump responded, quote, it's called seditious behavior at the highest level. That was in all caps. Each one of these traitors to our country should be arrested and put on trial. In subsequent posts, Trump wrote, lock them up, seditious behavior, punishable by death. Trump also reposted a statement saying, hang them, George Washington would. Now the Department of War is investigating one of the senators, Mark Kelly, for, quote, serious allegations of misconduct, threatening to call him back to active duty and court-martial him. Meanwhile, on November 17, 2025, the UN Security Council enshrined Israel's illegal occupation of Palestinian lands, put its imprimatur on Israel's genocide, and granted colonial control over the lives of the Palestinians to the United States, which has aided and abetted the genocide. The Council adopted Resolution 2803, by a vote of 13-0, Russia and China, both permanent members of the Security Council, could have vetoed it, but they abstained. The resolution incorporates Donald Trump's, quote, peace plan. It grants control over Gaza to the U.S.-led Board of Peace, and it orders the deployment of a U.S.-led occupation force called the International Stabilization Force, the ISF. Trump will oversee both colonial bodies in collaboration with Israel. Palestinians will not be allowed to participate in their own governance. Marjorie Cohn has written revealing articles for Truth Out about both of these alarming situations. Marjorie, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve.
Well, let's start with that video from the members of the Senate and Congress. Please explain to our listeners, were they right? Do members of the U.S. military have the right to refuse to follow illegal orders?
They were absolutely correct, Steve. And not only do service members have the right to refuse illegal orders, they have a duty to refuse illegal orders. The Uniform Code of Military Justice provides that a service member can be punished by court-martial for refusing a lawful order. Now, it doesn't define lawful, but the manual for courts-martial, which has the force of law, says that an order is lawful unless contrary to the Constitution, the laws of the United States, or lawful superior orders, or for some other reason is beyond the authority of the official issuing it. Now, although it may be inferred that an order to perform a military duty or act is lawful, that inference does not apply to a patently illegal order, such as one that directs the commission of a crime. Acting pursuant to orders is a legitimate defense unless the accused knew the orders were unlawful or a person of ordinary sense and understanding would have known the orders to be unlawful. Finally, the lawfulness of an order is a question of law to be determined by a military judge at a court-martial or at a war crimes tribunal. Normally, that determination can only be made after a service member refuses or disobeys an order. So the refuser takes the risk that a judge will find the order to be lawful and he or she will be punished for refusing to follow it.
Marjorie, give us some general examples of unlawful orders over time that members of the military acting inside or outside of the United States have the duty to refuse to follow.
Well, a couple of examples inside the United States. One is the use of military forces to deport, remove, or detain immigrants. The Convention Against Torture forbids the removal of someone to a country where there's a substantial likelihood of torture. The U.S. has ratified the Convention of Torture, making it part of the U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. A second example of unlawful orders within the U.S. is the use of military forces against civilian protesters. The Posse Comitatus Act forbids the use of federal troops to enforce domestic law unless there is a, quote, insurrection, unquote. Now, some examples of unlawful orders outside the United States include military attacks on vessels in international or foreign waters. And I know we're going to be talking more about this. An invasion or attack on, say, Venezuela, Mexico, Nigeria. The use of preemptive military force against Iran or China or another country. The use of nuclear weapons against any country, the torture or cruel treatment of civilians, prisoners of war, or other detainees, the intentional targeting of civilians, and, for example, attacking Palestinians in Gaza under the guise of so-called peacekeeping.
Let's talk about some precedents across the spectrum that you are discussing. In 1968, U.S. Army Lieutenant William Calley led 100 U.S. troops into the village of My Lai in Vietnam and killed 500 civilian women, children, and elderly men in what came to be known as the My Lai Massacre. Lieutenant Calley argued that he was just following superior orders. Was that defense upheld? What happened to Lieutenant Calley?
Well, first, let me say that charges were filed against 25 people, including generals. They were all dismissed or acquitted, except for Calley. Now, at his court-martial, he said he was following Commander Captain Ernest Medina's orders to kill all the villagers because everyone in the village was the enemy. Now, like the Nazi officials did at Nuremberg, Calley's defense, as you said, was that he was just following superior orders. But like the Nuremberg tribunal, that defense was rejected at Calley's court-martial. He was convicted of premeditated murder of not less than 22 Vietnamese people, sentenced to life in prison. Ultimately, Calley only served 3 years of house arrest and confinement to his barracks.
Can you cite examples of service members who refused to follow illegal orders during the Vietnam and Iraq wars and explain what happened to them?
Yes, during the Vietnam War, Dr. Howard Levy was a captain in the Army. He was chief of dermatological services, and he disobeyed an order to train Green Berets to be paramedics. He thought they would use their medical training to gain the trust of the Vietnamese people, who would then not oppose the U.S. troops carrying out their illegal missions. Levy called this the prostitution of medicine. He was charged with several crimes, and he tried to argue at his court-martial that the Vietnam War was illegal, that U.S. troops were committing war crimes. He was not allowed to raise that defense. He was convicted of all charges, dismissed from the Army, forfeited all pay and allowances, and sentenced to 3 years confinement at hard labor. Now, during the Iraq War, that's George W. Bush's Iraq War, in 2006, U.S. Army First Lieutenant Aaron Watata was the first commissioned officer to publicly disobey an order to deploy to Iraq. The Army charged Watata with missing movement and conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman. Watata said the war in Iraq is, in fact, illegal. It is my obligation and my duty to refuse orders to participate in this war. Now, at Watata's court-martial, the military judge refused to allow me to testify as an expert on the illegality of the Iraq War and the war crimes the Bush administration was committing there. The judge eventually declared a mistrial, and Watata was allowed to resign from the Army and was discharged under less than honorable conditions. And then another example from the Iraq War was the case of Pablo Paredes. I was allowed to testify as an expert in his 2005 court-martial. He was a U.S. Navy Petty Officer Third Class who refused orders to board an amphibious assault ship that would transport 3,000 Marines to Iraq because he thought he would be complicit as a war criminal. The Navy charged him with unauthorized absence and missing his ship's movement by design. Now, the military judge didn't allow me to testify in the guilt phase, and he convicted Paredes of missing movement by design, but dismissed the unauthorized absence charge. Once again, Paredes told the judge, I'm guilty of believing this war is illegal. I have a duty to refuse to participate.